Given that this is a reliability engineering certification, it makes sense to look at some of the non-parametrics that are related to reliability type data. I think there's only one in this group. Once again, non-parametrics is a way to avoid having to make assumptions about the underlying distributions. And it's a bit more conservative. So the Kaplan-Meier method, which we'll mention briefly, is one of those that you see in medical devices systems as it's really conservative in its approach and allows the data to have to be very convincing, in my opinion, versus making an assumption which may be difficult to justify. So it has a place in reliability and in life data, and it makes sense. Then we'll take a look at a couple other model or methods dealing more with comparisons. So non-parametric techniques have a wide range, and we're only talking about a handful of them here. So once again, make sure you spend a little bit of time with each of the non-parametrics listed in our table and in your primer or reading materials, your references, so that you're familiar with which ones are appropriate where and are able to recognize when you should use non-parametrics, but also then which technique is appropriate. Those are the types of questions that go after, do you fully understand these approaches? So the first one is Kaplan-Meier, KM as it's often abbreviated. And we see it, like I said, it mostly in medical systems and survival data analysis and looking at patient data and so on. And it's because it doesn't assume an underlying distribution, say a Weibull distribution or something like that. But it also works well with relatively small data sets, and it gives us a convenient plot if you take the same data and plot it out and so on. And it's conservative. It needs very convincing data to show a difference. So it's a convenient method. So Kaplan-Meier is basically taking a look at the data we have when failures or events occur, and then looking at how many are possible to have, what's the proportion that we're at risk at that particular time. So let's take a look at an example where we have 20 units on test. We've put them up on some kind of test, and they're being operated or manipulated or run or something like that. And we expect it to run for about 200 hours, and then we'll finish the test. And during that time, we've had 6 failures. And in the times listed here, 10, 32, 56, so on. And as the test operated, we also removed units for reasons other than failure. They were taken out to do some other form of testing unrelated to this particular life test. So they were censored is one way to call that. And we'll talk more about data like that a little later. And so we have 4 of them were removed, 50, 100, and so on, and list the hours there. And so we need to keep track of how many tests were available to fail at each point. And so that's what we're going to do. So out of all of the samples, half of them ran the full 200 hours and did not fail. We had 4 of them removed at 50, 100, and so on, and they had not failed, but they were removed from the test. And then we had 6 failures at the times listed. So let's take a look at the data. So I've got my 6 failures. Those are the points when I actually have information if something failed. And it's one of those things that I harp on all the time is that you should run tests to failure, get failures. One is you figure out what fails or have the opportunity to find out what fails. But more importantly is now you have information about the time to failure information that you need in order to make life estimates. So here I've got 6 points that had failures. And I'll get my pen. And the first failure we had at 10 hours, we had 20 units operating at that time. And then we had our first failure. Well, then we continued to run, and we had another failure at 32 hours. But we only had 19 items involved, right? The first one that failed was not replaced. It was taken out of the system because it failed. It wasn't available to fail, is one way to explain it. But here at 56 hours, instead of just having 18 available, remember at 50 hours, we removed an item. Now, that item didn't fail, so it doesn't get counted as a failure time. So the 50, this point, we removed an item, so it's not available to fail. And so at 56 hours, we only had 17 items. We had the two failures and the one that was removed. And again, there was another one removed at 100 hours, at 125, and at 150. And so we did a little bookkeeping here, and given our six failures, when the sixth one failed, we only had 11 units operating. And then after that, we had 10 units that went out to 200 hours. So that's one way of tabulating up the data, and it's the order of the failures, and they call it the counts, the count of the survivors. And so that's first step in setting up this data. And then we're going to do a little calculations. So here I've got that count of survivors, and what I'm interested in is what's the reliability value at that point in time. So if this is my time on the x-axis, what's my probability of surviving across the vertical axis? So if all of them survive the entire test, it'd be one. And if when all of them fail, I'm down to zero, 0.0. So one failure out of 25 is 95% reliable. I had a 5% failure rate. So at 10 hours, I ran from all of them running, and then it steps down. So I should be changing colors here a little bit, but I think you get the idea. And then I go out to 32 hours, and then it steps down again. This time, instead of 0.95, it's going to step down to 0.947, just slightly down, and so on. So these plots typically look like staircases going down. So as each item fails, it's a ratio of how many are available to fail versus the failure number that we had. So we end up with this staircase showing the probability. And then what you can do is if I have, say, two studies, and they would have slightly different behaviors, and they might be very similar, or they might be very different. And it allows us to make comparisons between them and to just plot the data. And if nothing else, is say on this red line here, if I'm interested at 100 hours, what's my probability of failure? Well, it's right there. Here's my probability of surviving 100 hours is given by that line. And so it's doesn't use a distribution. It doesn't give me a nice smooth curve unless you have lots and lots of data. But it does give me the ability to pick off points and say, well, what's the chance of surviving 100 hours? Well, it might be 0.94 or whatever, 94%. So it allows us to get after this information without making an assumption if it's a Weibull distribution or something else. So it's pretty handy in that regard. So another test that we're going to take a look at is called the Mann-Whitney U test. And again, I'm not really sure what the U comes from. It might be from the original paper. But it allows us to take a look at ordinal data. Again, it's this kind of rank ordering data that doesn't really make sense. But let's say we're taking two sets of data and we're looking at, you know, the amount of time that they've run, the months of life in the product. And here I've got life and months for these two different brands. And looks like brand X ran 2 months, 2 months, three. And there was one that it ran 6 months, whereas brand Y tended to run a little bit longer. So we tally up the scores of these ranks. There's a set of rules for dealing with them. Let's see if I have my value here. So these two were tied. So we split the rank for that. One of them is ranked one and the other one's ranked number two. And then you do the average of that. So it's 1.5 for that. And again, it, these two were the same, so they split that rank ordering. And so I've got one and two tied up in this first rank. Then number three, four and five are together here. We average them and so on down. So we do a little bit of work to rank order them, dealing with ties. And then we're able to then compare the average ranking between the two groups. And again, using something similar to a hypothesis test. So it allows us to do that. If the two brands were the same in their life of their data and their ability to survive, for example, their rank average should be the same. If not, if they are completely different values, lifetimes, as I would suspect with this particular example, then there should be a significant difference in their rank tallies. So basically, I'm going to do is add up these or get an average rank for each brand and then do a comparison between those two. So it's fairly convenient. Another one is a variation of that is the Wilcox and Mann-Whitney rank sum test. And again, it's looking at, do they have the same mean? So here I'm going to be calculating mean values, and did they come from the same population? And so if I'm, well, I should say, I'm comparing two sets of data, and did they come from two populations that have the same mean? Now, it doesn't really look at variation. So one could be very flat and one very peaked, but if they have the same mean, this test would detect that, is the idea. And again, I'm using the rank order of the data set, so it works with ordinal data also. Levine's test, I think that's how it's pronounced, and it's now looking at variances. And so unlike the last test, which looked at means but didn't really care about variance or the spread of the data, this one's looking at the variance of the data directly. Now, in parametric testing, if it's something similar to a normal test, we could use a F-test to compare the variance terms. But if we're not able to make that assumption that they're relatively normal distribution or symmetrical distributions, then Levine's test is a way to go after it. But it also allows us to compare more than two things. But it still goes back after and uses the F distribution to find the critical value. So we are able to take data that we know doesn't meet the underlying assumptions and look at the ranking of that data, and allows us to make the comparison anyway. In median tests, sometimes we're interested in the medians of two areas. So let's say we're comparing the median home prices in two regions, and are they the same or is one significantly higher than the other one? This would be an appropriate test for that. Like medians themselves, this median test is robust to the outliers. It's one of the advantages of dealing with median values versus mean values, the average values. All right, so we're going to include, I'm going to include a table that lists a range of these different nonparametrics and some of the critical notes on those things. And hopefully, as time permits, and I'll be adding worked out examples, and then you'll see some test questions related to these two within these different lessons. In the next section, we're going to do a short section on sample size and sample size determination. I should caveat this, is it's probably the most common question I've received once people found out I was had some statistical background, statistics training, is what sample size do I need? And I'm quite sure you've heard this question before.